Blog Talk Radio.
We'd like to thank everyone for allowing Africa on the Move the opportunity to come to your homes this evening, where we can have a interesting discussion on the bizarre case of Michael Fulton and the criminal justice system. That's right. It's a bizarre case as relates to Michael Fulton and the criminal justice system. This is the theme and the topic that we're going to discuss today. We'd like for our listening audience to listen in closely, and later on during the program, you'll be given the opportunity to call in so you can find out more about whatever issues or concerns that you may have as relates to this particular case. The purpose of discussing this case is because of the fact that this particular case can happen to any young African male who is growing up in this society and trying to be a productive citizen of society, but at the same time, beyond his own power, strange things can happen to you, and you become a victim of all kind of accusations. It's a case that very few people have heard of. It's because of this reason that Africa on the Move has made it an issue to come forward and help assist a young brother in trouble. We hope at the end of this program, you would have been giving enough information where you see the necessity that a threat to justice to one is a threat to justice and justice to all of us. So, at this point in time, we have one of our participants tonight, Brother Haki Machoki. He will come and share with our audience, first and foremost, a general backdrop. Let's talk about just the overall general backdrop of the history and the makeup of the criminal justice system as relates to African people and people of color. And from that, we will have live on the phone Miss Katie Fulton, who is the mother of Michael and Michael, who will come and speak to you, along with another advocate on the phone that will follow will be Miss Margaretta Stokes. She will come and share her experiences, not only on this case, but some of her experiences in dealing directly with the criminal justice system. So today, we want to highlight, we want to inform, and we want to share the case, the bizarre case of Michael Fulton. Brother Haki, as always, welcome to Africa on the Move.
Thank you for having me.
Brother Haki, for those who may not be familiar in terms of who you are, first time in this program, can you just give our people a general background of your history as a community organizer, activist, and an intellectual?
Well, I've been involved in community struggle for the last 30 years. I've been involved with numerous organizations from the AAPRP to African Student Union to African Awareness, Occupy. But my focus currently is the whole question around institutions and the role it plays in terms of moving our people forward under very problematic circumstances here in this country. So I feel that institutions, in terms of properly educating our children, make sure to empower them to move forward and also to address some mundane kinds of questions as it pertains to liberty and freedom and justice in the society.
Okay. Brother Haki, when one began to participate and try to analyze and try to engage with the U.S. criminal justice system, I think it becomes very important, first and foremost, for people to have a sound understanding foundation of the historical origin or whatever that is that you will be encountering. So since we are encountering the criminal justice system today, I'd like for you to give our people a general understanding of your understanding. What has been the general history of the development and the creation of the criminal justice system in America and its behavior impact on people of color, in particular African people?
Well, I think what's important to understand, and I know people have a hard time in terms of historically, you know, understanding or even looking at things historically, but it's quite important to historically look in terms of context, particularly when we talk about the context of global capitalist society, in terms of what it means in terms of African people being put on ships and brought to America. Now, having once arrived here, we understand that the primary focus of such a system was labor. It was how can you extract labor from people? Now, obviously, our people were brought over here not because of intelligence or our genius or what contribution we can bring to society or humanity. We were brought over for pure and simple way for economic reasons. And so, therefore, in that context, the question in terms of how can you extract labor out of these African people becomes paramount in terms of those who are in power. And so one of the things, the first thing they did was, in fact, once people were enslaved, the question in terms of do you have any say-so in terms of the kind of power that you have in terms of being able to resist your condition, and the situation, of course, was no. You had no power in terms of changing the paradigm that you find yourself confronted with. So therefore, if they wanted you to work, then you work. If you work sun up to sundown, then so be it. So the concerns in terms of the human as related to labor was not an issue, because what was most important for those in power was the extraction of wealth. And so therefore, the question in terms of how you get people to do that, how you extract their labor out there without paying them, was a critical question. Now the thing is that you could simply beat people in terms of making them work. I mean, clearly, I mean, our ancestors were whipped, brutalized, of course, and that was in itself sufficient enough to make us work. But as our people begin to struggle back, in terms of against this brutality, the question in terms of what do we do with these people who are actually beginning to stand up and to resist? Well, of course, the laws were changed to accommodate the needs of the very powerful, in the sense that your wealth was now extracted to you with the essence, knowing that if you don't participate in terms of your own exploitation, then we would simply incarcerate you. So we had the situation in this country where, that aside from the beatings, then the next thing to come was incarceration. So it was another way in terms of extracting labor from African people. Now, strange enough, and when you look at the context of extraction of labor from African people and in terms of related to incarceration of African people, that clearly a large number of African people find themselves on the outside of the law simply because, laws that were enacted, not because they wanted to dispense justice or not because they were about fairness or equity. It was about bottom line money, profit, pure and simple. One of the things that's interesting in the colonial era, one of the things that if just to indicate just how criminal-minded African people were, there was a term that they used in terms of psychology, which was formalized. I mean, it existed at centers of higher learning in this country, in which African people were defined as dreptomaniacs. In other words, if the ruling class can exploit your labor, then not only would you go to jail, but you would go to jail simply because you had a mental ailment which says that you weren't palatable to this notion in terms of your own exploitation, your own abuse, that somehow fighting against those kind of conditions makes you clinically insane, so therefore you should be incarcerated simply because you have dreptomania. So it says something in terms of the peculiar kind of history you get in this country in terms of the pursuit of money, to the extent that you're willing to marginalize, to dehumanize, to denigrate a people to the extent that they don't even have that these people are not perceived as having any kind of human rights that anybody is bound to respect. So this is the backdrop in terms of criminal justice. Now, one of the things as we go on and when we talked about this whole phenomenon in terms of criminality as related to African people in society, and one of the things that, as I alluded to earlier, when we talked about African people actually fighting back, for the in terms of economic justice, one of the things is that there were laws that changed in terms of respecting the fact that African people at some point in history, in colonial history, began to fight back, and so then the laws would change, and they were called black laws, and these black codes were all about essentially criminalizing any type of inactivity as far as powerful were concerned in terms of labor. So if you weren't involved in labor, if you weren't working for somebody, if you weren't allowing yourself to be used and abused, but that was powerful for the purpose of making money, then that means that you not only constitute a threat to the system of being, but also it says a lot in terms of your character. In other words, under the black codes, that if you weren't working for somebody, then you were, of course, a criminal. And so what happens to the criminals? Then, of course, you lock them up. And that's really the question, for instance, why would you lock up someone simply because of circumstances beyond their control? Well, for those in power, because African people weren't perceived as total people, whole people, then therefore the question in terms of, you know, the human desire, human aspirations were never an issue for them. It was merely a question in terms of how do you attract the labor, how do you criminalize these people to justify their enslavement, to justify, you know, using them to make large profits. And so the criminal justice system was used specifically for that reason. And the black code, it didn't just stop with the black codes. I mean, this whole phenomenon continued. The criminal laws themselves was also changed to the extent that when you talk about what it is to be employed, that the ability for African people to actually, you know, to self-employ, you know, to create wealth for themselves was something that was frowned upon. In fact, they see it as infringing on the domains of the white ruling class in terms of African aspirations to control their own labor, to benefit from their labor, and so forth and so on. And so those kind of pursuits of African people in terms of actually trying to create labor for them and wealth for themselves actually result in, again, incarceration of those people who dare do such a thing, because it's not in purview of African people to even espouse this idea in terms of using your labor to empower or to ingratiate yourself with wealth. This is perceived as a quote-unquote a white wealthy phenomenon, and therefore clearly this is a criminal act by some desperate African people, you know, who clearly didn't understand the proper etiquette in terms of, you know, living in America and all that entails. And so, again, African people were incarcerated solely for that purpose in terms of actually standing up for their right for economic justice. And so this question in terms of incarceration has always been a relevant question for African people, because throughout history, even currently, when you talk about incarceration of African people, there's always this economic proponent. When you look at the situation now, in terms of 15 years ago, there was a situation which people talked about that prison labor was competing with corporations, and they were concerned with that. Well, by having these prisoners, manufacture all kind of products, that you undermine corporate America's ability to make profit, and so therefore was a real concern. Well, since then, that concern in terms of competition against corporate America has long been discarded. So now there's no more discussion in terms of prison labor impacting on the corporate bottom line. Now it's okay for prisons to incorporate prison labor and to sell their products, because we've got a situation currently now where the economy is in decline. So therefore, you know, this cheap labor in the prison is indispensable in terms of, you know, the state, in terms of the ability to have products to sell, which are produced at relatively no cost because prisons are producing it, which feeds the state's bottom line. And so this continuation in terms of enslavement of African people in economics is a paradigm that continues even today. And so we've got to be very, very clear that when we talk about the prison industrial complex and what we're really talking about is money, and that's what we're really talking about.
Okay, let me ask you just to discuss, philosophically speaking, this whole concept, how to use the whole concept of crime laws in this society. How do laws benefit the rich and the wealthy versus being against the interests of the poor?
Well, you know, there's an old Chinese saying, governments create the crime, the criminals carry it out. In other words, the notion in crime is very, very important to create this dynamic of us versus them. If you can create this dynamic of us versus them, then exploitation of them, in this particular case, African people or people of color or poor people generally, becomes much easier to do. So crime is a kind of phenomenon that if you look at the evolution of crime in society, that the laws often change. At one point in history in society, you know, walking across the street wasn't considered a crime. Well, then you fast forward in the future, then what happens is walking across the street or jaywalking becomes a crime. And the question is, how does jaywalking hurt anybody in the sense that, you know, it's going to harm on anybody? It doesn't. It's about the power of the state to have control over the citizenry for the purpose of, in terms of, at some point, extracting labor from the citizenry. But in order to extract that labor, one of the very important strategies is that you have to pit people against one another. You have to convince people that some people are worthy and other people are not. And so the criminal justice system is used solely for that purpose. So if you have all these people who for whatever reason are lacking, or those kind of people who are marginalized or victimized, these people who are in fact, quote unquote, is coming to earth, then those in fact who benefit from the exploitation of that particular group feel better about themselves, because they don't have to look at themselves and see that there's a system in place which marginalizes and victimizes people. They can simply feel good about the fact that they are not part of that group. So this question of crime, you understand, always changes. And as the economy hits it, very dangerous that people have to understand that as the economy deteriorates, as there's less and less need for labor, as there's less and less opportunity for job, as wages continue to fall, you have excess number of people in which you don't have any need for. In the context of global capitalist society, the question is, with all these people you don't need, what are you going to do with all these people you don't need? Well, what you do is very simple. You change the laws to accommodate incarceration of more and more of those people. So in America, you got 2.5 million people who are currently incarcerated. Superimposed on the fact that you got 5 million people under the auspices of the criminal, parole and probation, 5 million people under parole or probation. Now, what does that say? What does that say in terms of the system? Either you're saying that people in America are predisposed to engage in crime, or there is a system in place which produces this large number of people who are currently occupying the criminal justice system who find themselves in prisons and or jails. So I think if you look at the latter in terms of, you know, there's this large number of people, then it's very, very clear that the issue is one of systemic. And the question is, so what purpose does it serve to lock up a large number of people? Well, think about it. If you got a system in place in which on average local governments on average run a deficit of $55 billion on average. If you get every city in this country, on average they run a deficit of $55 billion. If you look on the national scene and you look at printing up $85 billion a month in currency, then clearly this impact on the economy is a very deleterious one. So there's a negative impact on the overall economy, which means that access to jobs, access to decent wages, access to housing, access to decent education all become impossible, which inevitably means that there's an increase in terms of the number of people in which you don't need. So many people that you don't need. So the question for the system in terms of maintaining equilibrium, how do you get rid of all these people you don't need? Now, one of the things certainly they could do, they could kill off a large number of people. In fact, they're doing that. When you look at the level of contrition in the society in terms of their ability in terms of just wearing people down with all kind of medical ills in terms of diabetes, high blood pressure, heart problems, so forth and so on, clearly you eliminate a lot of people that way. But it's not going to eliminate the kind of people or the numbers that you need in terms of maintaining stability as far as the system is concerned. So the only way you can do it is large rates of incarceration. And so as a consequence, you find here in the 21st century, 2014, that kids as young as 13 years of age are being put in maximum secure prison with grown men. And the question is, now, what need does it serve to put a kid in a prison with grown men? Well, it's not so much as about the kid, well, being the child, as it is about the maximization of profit in terms of putting people in prisons where they're needed and making sure that, you know, they can produce, you know, wealth, you know, for the state. And so in the minds of those who run the system, if, in fact, you don't contribute economically, then as far as they're concerned, then your very existence is esoteric. In other words, you have no right to exist. So if you're going to exist, at least you're going to profit us. And so this is the function in terms of the criminal justice system. And this is a very real danger. So as the economy continues to deteriorate, and quite frankly, it will continue to deteriorate by its own, illogical policies, it will continue to deteriorate. The consequence is larger and larger number of people have to be incarcerated. There's no getting around that. So when we talk about incarceration, then we have to look at the question in terms of, injustice inflicted upon poor and African and poor people in terms of maintenance of the system. So with you or I or anybody at this point in history, is subject to be picked up for any reason, they can arbitrarily justify almost anything to justify people being in prison. Now, I should add, and I'm going to close, but I just want to add real quickly in terms of this phenomenon in terms of prison, is that we understand that with the privatization of prisons, right, it's done for two reasons. Privatization is one, it does that because privatizing prison makes it easier, you know, for the state to reduce its cost. So you don't have to pay for prisons because it's very expensive to incarcerate people. And on average, you're talking about $35,000 per year per individual to incarcerate them. But if you privatize them, it's not a problem. Secondly, privatizing prison makes it more efficient for those in power in terms of being able to give it to private individuals who can more ruthlessly exploit the inmates to produce products in which that institution can sell to the state at a cheaper cost, which benefits the state. So therefore, we understand that this notion in terms of the criminal justice system is going to expand leaps and bounds, and that we have to be concerned because any of us could possibly find ourselves in prison for something that was manufactured or concocted by those in power simply because the need for wealth or the need for the state to have cheap labor is so important to them. So we got to be very concerned about that reality.
You know, you said something really interesting earlier in your presentation about this economic crisis that this particular country is facing and how they use the criminal justice system to serve as a need to respond to these economic crises. One of the things I would like for you to respond to and try to give some sense of understanding to this particular phenomenon. And this is the phenomenon. I have seen reports, I heard reports, I have seen all kind of interviews where they have openly admitted that most recreation use of drugs are done in rural areas. More people in the rural areas use the drugs, valley drugs, in the cities. Way more. But yet, most of your incarceration take place in the inner cities over the use of the drug versus the rural area. How do you create a situation where they can openly say this and there seems to be very little response to this objective reality that the system knows that people are using drugs in certain regions, very little laws are being reinforced in that area, more so than it is being reinforced in the urban settings? What can you make from that when one can come publicly and even have the data to support that more drug use are used in rural areas, but less crimes are given out?
Yeah. Well, one of the problems is that, you know, police officers have a tremendous amount of discretion, and so they can pick and choose whether or not to arrest somebody for something like a bud, you know, for a marijuana cigarette. They have that option. One thing to understand that in the context of urban centers, that the police are under tremendous pressure from the system in terms of incarceration rates. Because keep in mind that when we talk about this whole notion in terms of the evolution of terrorism, we have to understand that because the system is very precarious, those people historically who have been marginalized, oppressed, denigrated, have by and large been, you know, people in your urban centers. They'll be people of color and your poor people. But in this context, particularly African people, so we have a long history in terms of standing up for injustice. And so as this injustice continues to escalate, then African people have no other choice but at some point to stand up and resist. And they understand that. And so what does the criminal justice system understand in order to undermine that whole process or to mitigate the chances that African people actually stand up and fight? The more we can incarcerate people, the more we can throw people in prison for, then the better we're off. So, but not only that, and keep in mind, so also in terms of in locking up large number of people, that's a second tactic that the state enjoys. That is that once you brandish people with a criminal record, then what? Of course, you can justify not employing them. This is very important people understand this. By locking people up for a marijuana cigarette or a bud or for just a stem or whatever, by by criminalizing them, by criminal record, it says that, in fact, they are drug users or drug dealers or drug users. It automatically eliminates them from the job market. Now, this is important because when you structure, when you look at in terms of what's going on in society, employment, the joblessness has nothing to do in terms of African people smoking marijuana. The lack of jobs is a structural problem. It's part and parcel of a global capitalist society in which, you know, all the wealth and power is distributed to a few people who enjoy the wealth of the society, so which when they have 99% of people, you know, who are struggling to exist day to day. And so, therefore, as opposed to looking at the system in terms of the structural maladies, in terms of how it increases unemployment and sustains high unemployment, it's easier to charge people in the urban centers with all kind of all kind of esoteric kinds of crimes. All kind of crimes really have no basis in terms of putting people, you know, involving people in the criminal justice system, serves a political need in terms of, you know, scapegoating those people in terms of as being quote-unquote criminal. And so this is the thing that's motivating, you know, the law enforcement in terms of going after African people in the cities because it's very, very easy. Now, keep in mind also, the one of the things to understand that when we talk about funding for criminal justice, Washington, D.C., the Congress, consistently talks about the fact that they have no monies in terms of allocating for anything. So when you talk about affordable housing, when you talk about expenditures for education, when you talk about when you talk about health care, when you talk about those things that are necessity for human beings, the thing coming out of Washington, the thing they say the most is that we simply don't have the funds to do that. But you know what? They have the funds to continually fund money into states and local in city locales in terms of quote unquote fighting crime. So the strategy is just a very simple one. The more people that you have involved in the criminal justice system, the more you can eliminate from the job market. You can blame them as opposed to understanding the structural maladies or structural problems in terms of facilitates lack of jobs. So it's much easier to simply blame those people for the fact that they can't find jobs because, in quote, they're criminals. And so it's a strategy that they use. And also, in terms of when you arrest people for petty crimes like having a joint in their pocket or whatever, they don't have an option in terms of school. University loan is no longer accessible to them just because they have a record in terms of using marijuana. And so therefore, in terms of access to loans or to grants for universities or even going to university becomes impossible. So with the stroke of a wand, those in power are able to achieve, you know, what they want most, that is the criminalization of people to effectively kick them out the job market to justify why they're not in the job market, conveniently allowing the system off the hook so people don't look at the system and say what it is. They tend to look at, quote-unquote, the other, which is the criminal, in terms of being his own worst enemy, not ever understanding that you have a system in place which facilitates all of this. So this is a danger that we all face.
Okay, we'd like to alert our listening audience tonight. You are listening to Africa on the Move as your host, Brother Africa. We're discussing the bizarre case of the Michael Fortin case and the criminal justice system. You have been listening to Brother Haki, who is giving his assessment and awareness about the historical development of this criminal system, as well as how it has impacted or played a role of the oppression of people of color, particularly in the African community. We say we have live today Sister Katie Fulton, who is the mother of Michael Fulton, and they will come on and discuss this particular case, which we believe is very important, not only to us as people of color, but important to all people in general, because as Brother Haki stated, we all are becoming prisons, becoming political prisoners, not only to the system, but to the greed of the system, which means that the only way the system right now can make money is seen to have a high level of incarceration of their own citizen, not only of their own citizen, particularly of their citizens of people of color. And right now, we have Sister Katie Fulton on the line, and we're going to talk about right now this whole case of what is the Michael Fulton case and how it will make impact on other future African youth and people in general. Sister Fulton, I see you on the line. We'd like to welcome you to Africa on the Move.
Hello.
Good evening, Sister Fulton. How you doing?
I'm fine, sir. Thank you.
Yeah. We have this question we'd like to fundamentally ask you. This whole program geared towards your child case. Very few people have heard about it, and we want to give you the opportunity to share with the world. You have the whole world listening right now in terms of what is the Michael Fulton case. We want to start from the beginning and give us what is going on with your son, Michael Fulton, and the criminal justice system.
Michael Fulton is a young man in Colorado. He has never had a problem with the law. And during a raid on my home, they confiscated Michael's computer and all of our computers from the home. They took our cell phones, cameras, and everything that would connect us to technology was taken from our home. When I asked them why they were doing this, Douglas County law enforcement officials told me that they had law enforcement officials on the Internet that had targeted my home and found that they had computer images that needed to be confiscated. So they seized our computers and took it away. From that point to this, Michael has been the subject and the target of their investigation, and they have sought to criminalize his name, and they are now at a point where we are trying to defend and support Michael to show that we have no knowledge of the computer images that they are referring to. We've never seen those images. We do not know how and when they came onto our computers. At this point, they had the Rocky Mountain Forensic Lab look at the computers and decided that they could produce a few pages of report from their forensic investigation. And we, in turn, have asked for someone to look at it on our behalf. The DA and the public defender have indicated that they would prefer, for Michael's defense, that they produce a copy of the disk that they examine and have our computer expert look at the same disk. And we find that to be undermining Michael's defense, because a computer expert on our behalf would need to look at the hard drive and all of the information which they have taken from our home so that they can assess how these images came onto our computer. So we now need to have an attorney who is able to ask the right questions to show that Michael is entitled to due process. This young man was totally unaware of what they were charging him with. The public defender indicated that Michael is not entitled to character witnesses, so that they're saying that the only witnesses that could come forth on Michael's behalf would be relevant witnesses, people who have knowledge about a computer and knowledge about how these things came onto the computer. I have no idea who that could be. Michael grew up in Colorado, and he graduated from high school with honors. He was recruited into college and spent 5 years on a college campus and completed his studies. So at this point, his life is on hold until he can clear his name and be exonerated of these bogus charges. As your guest eloquently explained, law enforcement officials can charge, and policymakers can draft laws that will create or criminalize individuals without their knowledge. So we are asking the public to please pay attention to what is happening with the Michael Fulton case in Colorado. We have never lived in Douglas County, yet it's Douglas County officials that are bringing these charges. We do need to have a computer expert who understands that this young man's computer is being used against him. We are living in an apartment complex and which several individuals have had access to our unit, and we can show that from time to time, individuals have been in and out of our unit without knowledge. The law enforcement officials that came into my home and took our computers away came in with a pass key. Therefore, I know that other individuals came in with pass keys. We are asking for any help from any computer expert or any attorney who has the knowledge, the skill, and the understanding to go pro bono and ask the right questions about how and why have they targeted this young man in Colorado, and how are they trying to criminalize his name, which rolls over into the same point that was made by Haki. Once you are in the criminal justice system, it is hard for you to get employment. It is hard for you to move forward in your career. They know that. So we're fighting for Michael's defense now. We're hoping that someone will give us support and respond. And if you would like to know more about Michael Fulton's case, feel free to write or call us. You can call us at 720-499-5146. If you are in a position to offer support, please send any information, funds, names, referrals to Save Our Sons, Post Office Box 58, Englewood, Colorado, 80151, or you can email me at saveoursons2013@gmail.com. We will be glad to share more information about you. Your help is always appreciated. We ask that you join the Save Our Sons Defense Fund now, because Michael deserves support, and we are asking for your help. Thank you.
Ms. Fulton, while we have you on the phone, there's a couple questions I must ask you, and I want you to share as much as you can so the people get a clear understanding of the current realities of what is going on. First and foremost, tell the people something about who you are. Who is Ms. Fulton?
I am a mature lady of color, and Michael Fulton is a young man, and I'm his biological mom. We are a former military family. Michael was born on a military installation. We have given and volunteered and supported our community in Colorado since 1998. We have never had a problem with any of our colleagues, friends, neighbors. We have been supportive of our community, and we have always reached out to help those in need. Michael has been instrumental in supporting me as I have prepared food baskets for individuals in need and transport individuals to health facilities who ask for help. Michael is a kind young man, and he has always been supportive of me as his mom and is presently working as a caregiver because my health, as I aged, deteriorated, and Michael has always been there to support me. We lived on the campus at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He never had a problem with his professors. He never had a problem with his classmates. He is a kind, understanding, intelligent young man who is trying to live his life.
Okay, Ms. Fulton, let me stop you for a second.
Yes.
Let me stop you for a second. In terms of
yes.
you, in terms of your accomplishments, what you have done for the last 30, 40 years as in terms of career wise. What did you do? What have you been able to accomplish as an individual? People will want to know that. Share that with the audience briefly, please.
Yes. For the last 20 plus years, I have worked with families in need. I am presently certified as a licensed professional counselor. I'm also a national certified school counselor. And I'm also a certified addictions counselor. I have put my life on hold to support my son through these ordeals. For the last 20 plus years, whether it's volunteer work or employment, I have gone out of my way to support families in need. I, too, graduated from the University of Colorado, and my focus is in family care. And I think that at some point, I will be able to continue giving to the community and supporting those in need. But as you probably know, my heart is broken because my son is more important to me, and he starts first at home and then spreads abroad. I have never had a problem with law enforcement. Mike and I have always tried to be law-abiding citizens in Colorado. We respect and support law enforcement officials in their jobs. I have sworn to defend the Constitution as an educator and as a health care provider. I have not deviated from my commitment, but at this point in our lives, we are struggling because we don't understand why Michael's computer has been targeted and is being used in a way to criminalize him. And that has put my life on hold.
Ms. Fulton.
I do hope that we will be able to continue our professional endeavors.
Ms. Fulton. Can you give us, why are you proud of Micah other than being your son? What academic accomplishment has he achieved, and where, what direction is he planning on taking in the near future? What are the things you'd like to become?
I saw Michael go through high school, and I never experienced any kind of harassment from him. He never asked for expensive clothing or expensive tools. He accepted what we could afford. He never reached out beyond his financial means. I saw Michael interact with teachers, classmates, and colleagues. I observed him as he was recruited in the pre-collegiate program from Englewood High School. I have first-hand observation of his interaction with his teachers and the community. When he was recruited into Boulder, he went into a program that required long hours of tutoring. He never resisted. He never departed. He did not drop out. He completed his studies in mathematics and engineering, supplemented that with science courses, and wants very much to pursue med school. At this point, his transcripts will show his commitment and his discipline, as well as his aptitude and his attitude. The transcripts from CU Boulder is a matter of record. The transcripts from Front Range Community College is a matter of record. The transcript from Community College of Aurora is a matter of record. This young man has spent most of his life trying to improve himself, trying to reach for something that is positive, trying to make a valuable contribution to society. He has been most respectful and supportive in my home. That's why I share with you today that regardless of my training, regardless of my experience and contribution, my focus right now is on my son. He's first and foremost.
Okay, in terms of, I believe he was in the process of taking his exam to become a teacher. Is that true?
Yes, he completed the place exam. He completed that with the understanding that he had a valuable contribution to make as an educator. He enjoyed math. And now, because of these charges, he cannot have access to children under 18. So he's, as I said before, his life is on hold. All of the investment that he's made in his academics, having successfully completed the place exam, having successfully prepared himself to enter a profession of education, his life is on hold until these charges are resolved.
Now let's talk more specifically now about the case. We're trying to be real clear with it because millions of people, many, many people are listening. And I know there are things that they would like to know. Can you go back from the beginning? Give us a time period. When did the police first come to your home? And how did they come to your home? What rights and violations that may have been committed, or we believe it has been committed, but that got to be proven in a court of law. But at least just give people a general scenario on what physically took place and the terror that took place in terms of how they came to your home and some of the contradictions that existed as a result of that.
It was on April 4th, 2013. A year and 1 month ago that they came into my home with a pass key. I'd say anywhere from 8 to 10 law enforcement officials entered my home with gun point. A gun was drawn in my face. I was ordered to leave my home immediately. With the gun in my face, I complied. I walked outside in my nightgown. It was early in the morning on April 4th, 2013, I'd say approximately 9:15 to 9:20 in the morning. When I stepped outside, it was cold. They entered my home, one after another, and they had black uniforms on. Nothing in the front of their uniform, as I could see, said police, so I really was not aware as to who they were. And I asked them to give me some identification, and they did not comply. They just indicated that I needed to stay outside and out of the way. They proceeded to ramshackle and search everything in sight, the bedroom, the closets, kitchen, dishwasher, Michael's room, my room. Anything that they thought that they could take, they did. I asked them over repeatedly to tell me what was wrong. They said they were looking for Michael. I said, Michael is not here. Michael was not home at the moment, and apparently they did not believe me, so they proceeded to search. After searching everything at their discretion, and they concluded that Michael was really not present, then they started to confiscate those things that they thought would give us access to communication. That's when they started to take away the computers, the phones, cameras.
Your personal phone, as well as your personal phone.
Yes, correct. And
as well as your personal monies, the monies that was in your pocketbook.
Yes, I asked them if I could please have my medication and my purse, and they searched, before giving me my purse, they searched my purse. Now, my purse is the average size of any lady's purse, and it was obvious that Michael was not in my purse. But they searched my purse, and they confiscated at their discretion whatever they thought they would take and would need. when I asked for my medication, they handed me my medication from the kitchen counter and a glass of water as I waited outside. At one point, I asked if I could come in and put something on. They said that I don't need to come in, but I could go to someone's home. They insisted that I leave my residence and go to somewhere else because they were going to be all day. I explained to them that it would not be appropriate to go to someone's home in my nightgown, insisting that I leave the resident and leave the premises. I was too embarrassed to go up to a neighbor's door and ask for any assistance in my nightgown. When they allowed me to come in to put something on, one of the two female officers followed me into the bedroom and watched me as I took my nightgown off and dressed myself so that I could go and try to find help, so that I could go and try to find a phone so I could call someone for help. It was very humiliating. It was very unnecessary because there was nothing in my background that indicated that I was a criminal.
According to the document that you have sent out earlier, Ms. Fortune, you indicated that not only did they come to your home, but they came into your home while a valid warrant.
Yes.
Can you confirm that statement?
Give the permission. They did not give me a warrant. They did not give me a warrant, and I asked them repeatedly for one. When I decided that I needed to go and ask for help, and I came back to find a second group of law enforcement officials in my home. The second group of law enforcement officials said that they were from Arapahoe County, and I asked them the same question. I said, do you have a warrant? What gives you the right to be in my home? And what gives you the right to keep me out? They explained to me at that point that they did not have a warrant, but they were waiting for one to be delivered to them. And until one would be delivered to them, I would have to remain outside. This was now moving into the afternoon. I again complied. I stayed outside as they continued to search and ramshackle and seize things at their discretion from my home.
So at this point in time, we can assume that you was very frightened because I'm quite sure you felt intimidated with the guns drawn up against your head, with the policemen surrounding you, with you being by yourself. We recognize that you had stated that they took not only his computer, but all the computers and other devices that had nothing related to or to do with their so-called accusation up to this point. Let me ask you this, Ms. Fortune. Can you give the audience, some people don't know, why would they target Michael? Why would they target
Michael? This is a question. This is a question that I've asked myself repeatedly because Michael has not done anything to anyone that would draw this kind of attention to him. And several things have come to my mind. That one of the things in particular is that on the 22nd of March, 2013, Michael was with me in federal court. He supported me as I went before Magistrate Watanabe with the case of discrimination. This case was filed in 2009 in federal court. And the case number is 12 CV 03005. That case pertaining to an employment discrimination case before Judge Watanabe, because the case was reviewed through the protocol, and the case refers to an application which I filed for work, and my application was never given to the hiring committee. The committee was not aware that I had applied for employment with the VA. The committee was not informed of my qualifications and my desire to work. And I felt at that point that if I had applied for work which I was qualified for, which I had met all of the criteria for, and I was denied an employment opportunity, then I asked for help through the EEOC. The EEOC gave me the option of filing in federal court, which I pursued. And I think that when Michael stepped up in support of his mom, this could be one of the factors that he became a target, because we traveled. Before filing this case in federal court in Denver, Michael traveled with me to Atlanta, Georgia, in which we went before the EEOC commission and explained that I was applying for work, that I was qualified for the announcement that I applied for, and that I was being denied an equal employment opportunity. Michael was with me. I think one of the factors indicates that Michael may have become a target at that time. And for March 22nd, 2013, it was less than a month, only a few weeks, that they came into my home. It was April 4th, 2013, that they invaded my premises and confiscated Michael's computer.
Yeah, also, Ms. Ford, I think it's something very interesting in terms of your case that the audience would need to know is that you stated that there was a janitorial maintenance man that worked there for a long period of time at that particular apartment complex. But right
with
before they came
house?
In
that's
to raid your home,
yes.
Can you explain
right.
that to
house?
The audience as a possibility? Yeah, explain it to the audience.
Right. We had lived on the property for these 10 years. Rigoberto Escamilla was the maintenance man here on property for 8-plus years. He has access to all of the units on the site. We thought that we had a fairly decent rapport with him. He's been in and out of our home several times. We were not aware that he had left the property in the middle of the night just a few days before they invaded my home. He had packed up his family, pets, plants, all personal items, and left the property in the middle of the night. There was no indication and no notices of his departure. It leads me to believe that he and others were coming in and out of my home at their discretion. We have still not...
You have had some neighbors... that had shared
yes,
with you that they have seen them in at your apartments at times when
yes,
no one was there
of course.
Without you knowing it.
They have seen him in and out when we were not here. They apparently thought that he had permission. He did not. He did not. And I think that puts the case of Michael Fulton, where he has to defend himself against a charge based on computer images and access to computers, in which many people have had access to the computers. So it makes no sense. As your other guest eloquently stated, policymakers can draft laws and policies to criminalize individuals and have you defend yourself that you may not even be aware of. So, Michael.
Ma'am, before we finish your point, Ms. Winton.
Michael is trying now to ask for help so that someone will be able to understand that he has not done anything wrong. And the charges which he is facing now are serious felony charges which can alter his life. And these charges are based solely on the computer that they took from our home.
Ms. Fulton, you also recognize the possibility of information coming in from the outside on his computer. You talk about this relationship with the computer company, Comcast, and also
yes.
finding someone maybe outside with a wire running up to your home. Can you talk a little bit about those scenarios for our audience?
Yes. Yes, Michael was not aware at the time, and neither was I, to be honest with you, that Comcast had sent out a notice to Michael stating that it appeared to them that his computer may have been affected by a bot, B-O-T. Michael did share with me after this ordeal with law enforcement that he was not aware either, but he did know that his computer was acting very strangely. He had no control over it. He thought it was just something that it was a virus. He figured that if it was a virus, then he would have to look for something to help clean it up. But now, it appears as though it was much more than that. We shared that email that we got from Comcast with law enforcement, with the public defender.
Now, what is
and
the
now
email?
They're saying that, yes, an email came from Comcast indicating that it appears as though something was wrong, which really does substantiate Michael's observation that someone else had control of his computer.
Okay, Ms. Fulton, we wanted you to come and share the story with our audience. There are many other issues and contradictions that we can discuss, but because it is a legal battle and Michael haven't legally been given his chance yet to defend themselves in the courts, and we are in the process of, is in the process of being, you know, litigated, we'd like to ask you how can the public help? Again, how can they support you? And I believe we'd like to maybe see if we can speak to Michael just for 1 minute. I'm quite sure the audience would like to hear his position on the allegations.
Oh, sure.
First of
sure.
All,
Michael is here. Michael is here with me, and he appreciates the opportunity to share. He's under a lot of stress, and he's holding up, taking one day at a time. He's not broken, and he's hoping that someone will offer their support. I'll let you speak with Michael.
Okay. Yeah. Hello, Brother Robinson. And all the folks out there.
Hello, Michael. How you doing today? Good.
Yeah, I'm trying to hold
Michael.
That, but thank you for making sure I'm helping Mom out here. You know, it's just us out here. In Colorado.
Michael, we know it's very
yes,
stressful.
Sir.
And we just want the story to get out and the truth to get out. Based upon
yes,
the
sir.
Research and evidence that we have done so far, we are in support of your innocence. But the public would like to hear your position on these allegations. What is your position on these allegations? What would you like to say to the public?
Okay, yes, absolutely, sir. Thank you. Thank you for letting me speak on it. And yeah, I just want to let everyone know that I've never been accused of this. I don't have anyone have any doubt of this, you know, that I'm guilty of this. I'm not guilty of it. I pled that on the last year, December, in front of the judge in court. So we're scheduled for trial now on the 22nd, but I think these charges are for respect of the all the listeners out there, BS. I was trying to clean my language on that. But yeah, I think that they are totally BS, and I think that they're just bogus trying to make Trump up to try to go after someone that's, you know, that's trying to be successful and try to help out other African Americans and other people out there. and they're just trying to come up with whatever they can.
And, Michael, before you leave, we understand that you're being put under pressure to where you had to report monthly on drug tests and everything. How have you done on your tests?
Oh, yes, sir. Thank you. Yes. Yes, all negative. No, I don't take anything. No drugs, no alcohol, no marijuana. And but I don't, you know, blame anyone who is in that situation to do so, but I do not do that. And they try to get some anything, so I have to be absolutely perfect in the legal system until court. So I've been absolutely perfect, as they say, quote unquote.
And it's my understanding that your record was so perfect, you've been so clean, that they took the bracelet off of your ankles, which should have never been on in the first place. That's another issue that we have to deal
right,
with.
Sir.
But because of that, you were so clean, so precise, so thorough, so committed to follow the process, that they had no other reason but to do that. Is that true, Michael?
Yes, sir. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Yes, correct.
Okay, Michael. We thank you for your time. We hope the audience hear your appeal, hear your cry, and we'll be staying in touch with you. You can put your mom back on. We thank you for sharing your innocence with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Robinson, for your time and speaking to Michael. Michael, as you know, was on ankle bracelet, and that was something that the court came to understand really was not necessary, because Michael was not a threat to the community. He's not a flight risk. He's dealing with this as a man, and he's trying to clear his name. And he understands that a lot of time has been spent requesting that he submit himself to you, to unannounced, you know, UAs. He's done that. All of his UAs have been clean. He's never expressed an interest in doing drugs. In fact, he has supported my efforts in working with families to be drug-free. And I think that at this point in his life, he's been trying very hard to move forward in a positive way. So these charges are so detrimental and so serious that we do need help in building his defense.
Ms. Fortin, before you leave, I know you only have a few minutes left, in terms of appealing to our listening audience, financially, you say you cannot afford to pay the lawyers and the experts. What kind of monies are they talking about to hire a lawyer and get a specialist?
Right.
Can you let the audience know the kind of money we are talking about and how they can contribute?
Right.
You also have an account set up at the bank, at the Wells Fargo Bank, where they can contribute. But first, talk about the amount of monies that you need to get Michael an adequate defense, and at the same time, how can people actually help you, who want to help you, who hear your appeal, who hear your cry for support?
The attorneys that we have had an opportunity to speak with understands that these charges are egregious, and that many of them understand as well that these charges are based on computer images. They are asking for $25,000 to engage and to make an appearance, to enter an appearance. For an additional $5,000 to $10,000 for a computer expert to examine the computer. We do not have the resources for that. We are asking any listening audience, if they're in a position and can help, to go to Wells Fargo Bank and make a donation into the Save Our Sons Defense Fund, INC. The account number there, 84-8252-7028. If you have any questions about making a donation at Wells Fargo Bank, you can write to us at Post Office Box 58, Inglewood, Colorado, 80151, attention, Save Our Sons Defense Fund, and we will appreciate and generate the funds necessary for Michael's legal defense. Again, that Save Our Sons Defense Funds, INC, at Wells Fargo Bank. Or you can email us at saveoursons2013@gmail.com. Your help would be very much appreciated.
Okay, Ms. Fulton, if you want to, you can wait around. If we get some callers, they may want to talk to you. But if you can't, we understand. But what we want to do right now for our listening audience, we have an advocate on the line who has been working with Ms. Fulton, and we're going to bring her in. We want to talk to her a little bit about her general encounter with the judiciary system, and more in particular, her take on this particular case. What are some of the things she found out that is very interesting and intriguing? So right now, we can bring in one of the advocates of the Michael Fulton case, Marita Stokes. Marita, how are you doing today? Welcome to Africa on the Moon.
I'm doing well. Thank you, Mr. Robinson.
Good. You know, one of the things people might not know who you are, but based on my research, I know you have had some encounters with the criminal justice system. I would just like you to general make a statement something, how you would categorize your encounter with the criminal justice system and how it's sort of consistent to some of the things that you have found out about the Michael Fulton case.
Well, my encounter with the system caused me to go ahead and actually become a great researcher of the system and how it works, because I had experienced charges were from, I had experienced police abuse, and then what happened, instead of the police being examined by the rule of law, I was confronted with a very vindictive district attorney that stacked charges, just much like what's going on with Michael presently, because he's being not only charged by one district attorney that happens to be very much politically driven, in my estimation, but also another county up here in Colorado that's engaged in stacking charges, which is really common, that charge stacking, because it's where police and prosecutors are able to create a case with numerous violations, so they say, so that it convinces a defendant like Michael to take a plea. The problem in Michael's case happens to be sex charges or felony, and he's being charged with three felony counts of child exploitation. The minimum on that in Colorado is a two-year mandatory minimum with up to a life sentence. That's how serious these charges are. And what happens here is that Michael is entitled to have a defense. The problem with the system, as I found out, I was fortunate enough to have a private defense. But in Michael's system, with a public defender who is taking on so many, has a tremendous caseload, is that in it's going to be more than a year's time that there's not been an investigator that has been able to just look at some of the discovery that they've had access to, and that Michael has not been able to go ahead and see. Their argument happens to be that it would be improper for Michael or his defense to look at discovery, because with all those pornographic images on there, it could go ahead and cause more problems for those victims who they're saying that are children that were exploited through the images that Michael has on his system. However, there was a great paper that was written here, which talks about Michael's being able to have adequate defense, which is to say that the judge, and we're hoping that, you know, we are able to get a very aggressive forensics expert and then also a defense attorney that can talk about striking a proper balance. Because what happens is that Michael still deserves the right to see the actual, or his defense does, to see what he is being charged of. You know, we don't know how this was able to get on his computer, and there are numerous ways of where our a defense expert, a computer expert, would be able to identify that. It was not too long ago that, and actually it was on March 7th of 2012, that there was Jason Livingood, who happened to be the vice president of Internet Systems Engineering in Comcast, who was able to talk exactly about what was going on to a Senate subcommittee, or no, excuse me, a House of Representatives subcommittee on what's going on with computer viruses and then how so many millions of customers were affected by what had happened. It was Comcast right now has over 18 million residential and business broadband customers, but they have been subjected to malicious web bots. And that was the email that they had sent out to Michael. And that bot can cause a significant harm to individuals or and the entire network. And what we're finding out is that it can result in credit card theft, identity theft, and it can be used to go ahead, as it was testified by this senior executive at Comcast, spam and malicious and criminal activity. What we would like to be able to do is to check those system registries and have a qualified individual that could speak to the harm that it poses to so many different individuals who happen to be innocent users that can just be surfing the Internet, and then all of a sudden there is this malicious bot that is placed on their computer and puts pornography on there. But if you go ahead and take a look at some of the history or recent history of what's going on in Colorado, you're seeing that the number of convictions that are happening in Colorado, where most of the lifetime offenders, that they aren't killers and they aren't individuals that are involved in other crimes, they're getting life sentences for sexual exploitation and child pornography. And so this is rampant, and I really feel that what happens is that the citizens need to be aware that this could happen to them, and unsuspectingly. And so what happens is that Michael needs to go ahead and have an expert. He needs to have someone who's committed to being able to point out how these charges are systemic, and they have to be reviewed. How we have there's no leeway in terms of where the district attorney is trying to go ahead and be fair. It is a process, and the process, and I would agree with your first guest where he talks about there's a money making process at the end of the day, and no money justifies taking one single day from anyone's life on some of these different malicious bots that are out there that are planted for whatever reason to an unsuspecting user who has nothing, who has done nothing but done good in the community and has been a contributing member, and that society, because it mandates, or we're talking about that they're going to gain a profit from detaining its citizens in federal prisons or state prisons, is a travesty of justice. So back to my opinion on the system, I believe the system is designed to be a net and ensnare a lot of innocent people as well as those who are truly guilty of crimes. But it's not done in such a way where Michael is geared towards having a fair trial. It's geared so that Michael is feeling so forced because of the mandatory minimum sentencing that he will feel compelled to take a plea bargain rather than go ahead and fight for his innocence. That's where I'm at. Thank you for your time.
Okay, let me just ask you this question in terms of looking at Michael's reality. He's out in Colorado, which I know that particular state in general has a very small African population. Given the fact that it has a small African population, most likely your jurors or your peers, which they say will basically be predominant of European people. Not only European people, but be a European people with a certain type of mindset where they look at African, young African men from a different perspective. If he went to court with all the facts that he has, how can we still assure that he get a fair trial? What's your take on that?
Transparency. I would ask that, for instance, that there would be participation in the civil process, in the criminal process, where there are observers in the courtroom, and they're able to go ahead and make demands and asking the district attorney to explain why it is that Colorado has such a high increase in sentencing. For instance, it came out in the Denver Post. It said that in Colorado prisons, the number of men and women serving life sentences for sex offenses is 41 times greater than it was just 14 years ago. So I'd really like someone from their office to really explain that. But it's not happening just in the Denver metro area and south of that. It's happening throughout this country. And so what happens, I believe, is that Michael's case can go ahead and really provide insight as to why these sentencing laws are happening and why it is that someone who is just using his computer and trying to be an educator is now being raked across the coals unnecessarily and really, as you mentioned, not having a jury that is going to be of his peers, because in my case, and my African-American woman, I had an all-white jury, and I was able to defeat this. But what happens is that if Michael is not able to almost get what's a unanimous, if this goes to trial, and if he's not able to go ahead and have a fair part of the jury vote in favor of him, the district attorney has the right to go ahead and retry him again. And what it does in terms of financial resources, it depletes your financial resources, and in terms of the emotional stress, it is incalculable. And what happens is that it doesn't only affect Michael, but it is severely affecting those who are close to him as well. And that is it's a crying shame.
Yes, they're like just explained the criminalization of the poor. With that in mind, I would like to go back to Brother Haki. He also has been an advocate in this case. And Brother Haki, based upon what you know and what you have heard, just share some thoughts on this right now with the listening audience in terms of why this should come in the aid of Brother Michael Fulton.
Yeah, well, this is absolutely correct. The whole judicial process is an adversarial one. It's not about truth. It's not about justice. And it's about winning. And as just alluded to the fact that this guy has political aspirations to move up the ladder, then, of course, the lives of or poor people, particularly poor black people. It's not really important to these guys. And so this is a real danger that we have when we talk about, these kind of cases. One of the things is that, there are those out there who believe that, in fact, these kind of things don't happen. But as it was alluded to, when you look at the terms of public defenders, I mean, you look at their pay. In Virginia, for instance, they get something like, I think it's something like $50, $60 per individual. And in southern states like Mississippi, is even less. And so, therefore, there's a monetary impetus among, public defenders to gain as many clients as possible in terms of being able to make a decent living. So the priority is not representation of your client, but the priority is to amass enough money to live on. But there's also a catch. One of the things is that, keep in mind, as a public defender, if you don't please the powers that be, those people who allocate your client base to you, then you don't get clients. So it's a very subtle kind of punishment. If you don't play ball, we'll penalize you by not giving you clients, which means you don't make no money as a public defender. And so there's a real incentive for public defenders to play ball. And this is the danger when we talk about the allocation of justice in the society. So as long as there's a monetary value on justice, and those among us who are the poorest, those of us who have access to resources, will always be victimized by a ruthless and unjust system. And we have to understand that. So none of us should believe that, in fact, that from our churches that somehow we're safe. It can happen to any of us, any of us. They could pick us up. In the case of Geronimo G. Jacob Pratt, at the time in which he was charged with killing a police officer. This man was in California. I mean, in this case, I mean, the alleged cop that was actually assassinated happened with tens of thousands of miles away from where Geronimo Pratt was. It didn't matter. They fabricated evidence. He ended up spending 27 years in prison for something he didn't do, and everybody knew he didn't do it. It didn't matter. He didn't have the resources to combat an injustice. The system is vicious and cold. When you talk about in Philadelphia, you talk about Abu Jamal. When we talk about this Officer Faulkner and his death, even though it's very clear that the many witnesses who testified against Memorial Abu Jamal were paid by law enforcement, by the so-called criminal justice system, he's still languished in prison today because of that. And everybody knows that he was railroaded in prison, but it doesn't matter. So he's only like 19th year in prison as we speak. And so everybody knows that he wasn't guilty. So it's not a question of transfer your guilt or your innocence. It comes down to a question of monetary value. For those who represent the system, money is more important than anything else. Prestige is more important than anything else. You don't gain the next job making more money by allowing people to be acquitted. On the contrary, you move up by convicting people. Whether or not they're innocent is inconsequential. It's not really important to those people in power. And if people that's afraid don't understand what I'm saying, then perhaps they're not thinking. But this is very, very real. So you ask the question, why should we support Brother Michael? One, he's a young brother doing good things. He's a role model for youth in terms of we aspire for our youth to do good things. We want him to do good things. We tell him the importance of education. This brother actually excelled. A lot of credit goes to his mother in terms of pushing him to do the kind of things that he did in terms of academic excellence. So we need young brothers like in the community to be a sure role model to other young brothers who think that the situation is hopeless. Secondly, as I alluded to, we have to understand that as long as the system is in place, which is about the exploitation of those who are worthless, those who are powerless, those who are poor, those who perceive as the epitome of the scum of the earth, then we can understand that many of us fall within that purview in terms of as far as the system is concerned. So the color of your skin, even though those of us who want to believe that in fact that the color of your skin is really irrelevant in terms of this dispensation of justice, we have to wake up and realize that color is very much instrumental in terms of the kind of justice dispensed when it comes to people of color. Your sister talked about being tried by a jury of peers. Well, in a place like Colorado, in places, certain rural parts of Virginia or the South generally, then being tried by your peers is a very difficult thing because prosecutors arbitrarily decide to strike people from juries based upon simply something as simplistic as their skin color.
And so, therefore, you end up with a situation in which you're tried by people who, maybe for whatever reason, have a great hatred of you simply based upon your skin color. But yet, these people are called upon to minister justice. So we understand how precarious the situation is, and we have to understand. Thirdly, we got to support Brother Mike because, as the sister alluded to, we have to create some paradigm which says that this kind of targeting, this kind of hollowing of the judicial system has to stop. And the only way it's going to stop that, it has to have more visibility. So the sister talked about, in the last 10 years, a 41% increase in terms for these kind of computer crimes. But then we need to know why that's so. And the only way you can do that is we have to have a process which is transparent and clear. And the only way you can do that is to force people in power to account for the fact what's going on. So all those reasons are why we have to defend the young brother. We have to support the young brother. We have to send the money in. We have to get a quality lawyer. We cannot count on a public defender to adequately represent this young brother because his focus is not about representation. It's about monetary value. It's about getting as much money as he possibly can. And so when we talk about in terms of the fear that exists among public defenders, then we understand it's a legitimate fear because that's their livelihood. That's how these guys make a living. And if they don't play ball, then there's no money to be made, which means they can't pay their bills. So these guys are caught up in a precarious situation, and that's just the cold reality in terms of it all. But please, I beg everybody, please, if you can, please support the young brother financially. I mean, they really need a lawyer in terms of, making sure that they can bring the proper case to bear, and challenge the rules and to actually deal with a lot of the inconsistencies in terms of application of the law that the sister Katie Fulton has articulated in terms of things that they did that were wrong in terms of criminal law. So we need a reputable lawyer in terms of representing his young brother. So I implore people, please, to assist the young brother.
Okay, to our listening audience, you're listening to Africa on the Move as your host, Brother Africa. We are talking about the bizarre case of the Michael Fulton case and the criminal justice system. We see that we still have his mother online, Ms. Katie Fulton. But before we go back to her, we'd like to let our audience know that our phone line is open. You can call in at 323-679-0841. 323-679-0841. Make sure you press 1 if you'd like to if you'd like to ask a question or have a comment. We have some callers on the line. I'll go to my first caller. First caller, your last four numbers is 4298. Caller 4298. Welcome to Africa on your Move. Your question or comments for tonight, caller.
Yes, good evening, good evening. It's great to be on the show. I'm thankful for your guests. We not only need this to speak truth to power, but we've got to start empowering people who need to be empowered, such as this young man here. I'm a Marxist, and I'm into scientific socialism as the father of scientific socialism is called Marx, just like the father of Christianity is Jesus, and it's just a fact of life. I think that the state, the government, has laws that protect the interests of the wealthy, of the property owners, and of the wealthy, and these laws are used to subjugate anybody who is not operating in their interests. And, we as a people are being subjugated and oppressed and repressed and jailed because we practice our culture, and Solomon smoked the weed of wisdom, and our culture is being oppressed. But anyway, on this case of this particular young man, I'm not sure why the government would be targeting him, but I'm sure when all the dust clears, there's somebody's interest, somebody's copyright, property, some kind of money involved in it. And we need to support this young man because he's being criminalized, and we didn't get too many people criminalized as it is. Thank you.
Okay, caller, we thank you and continue to support Africa on the Move. We go to our next caller, caller 3330. Caller 3330, welcome to Africa on the Move. Your question or comment, please.
Thank you for having me. My comment is that given the current technological landscape, it's not unusual that these type of infringements on our rights are going to happen, because if you do research, you notice there's a trend going on where all the major technological companies are buying smaller companies to maintain influence. So at the end of the day, this is not unusual. These kind of things will happen because anytime you have conditions where the few control the majority, they're going to be subject to abuse their powers, and for those that do not have their access to influence, there's no telling what can happen.
Okay, Carlo, thank you for your support and continue to support Africa on the Move. Thank you for your comment. Going back to Ms. Fulton. Ms. Fulton, one of the things about your call for supporting Michael in terms of sending a contribution to save our fund, save our fund,
yes, sir.
Save our fund incorporated. One of the things about that,
yes,
you have decided to make that not just only for Michael, but to use it as a future tool, as a future component to help and support future youth who may find themselves in that position. Can you talk about that a little bit, about why you have chosen to do that?
I think it's important to support young people who are trying very hard to do the right thing. I know that we always have a challenge before us when you see a young person with the attitude that they really do not want to be in the streets, and they really do not want to break the law. They really only want a chance to make a contribution to society. Sometimes along the way, they may find themselves challenged and not able to reach their goal. This fund, Save Our Sons Defense Fund, is in place to help those individuals who are in need of financial support in order to help them move in a positive path for their future. I think it's important that we reach out, reach back, reach down to support individuals who have shown us through their pattern of behavior that they are willing and able to do the right thing. Michael's case is a case that is challenging us to defend his innocence to the point in which many individuals will come to understand that past behavior is a good prediction for future behavior. If in all the years here in Colorado he has made wise choices, he has decided that he wanted to do the right thing, there's no reason in the world for anyone to conceptualize that he has any intent of hurting anybody, especially children. I think that if you are in a position to help make a positive difference, we ask that you make a contribution to Save Our Son Defense Fund. You can do that at any Wells Fargo bank, or you can ask the clerk to enter your donation on behalf of Michael Fulton into Save Our Son Defense Fund, INC, account number 84825270028. If you have any challenges or difficulty doing that, you can write Save Our Sons Defense Fund, Post Office Box 58, Englewood, with an E, Colorado, 80151. If you send it to the attention of Save Our Sons Defense Fund, we will be glad to respond. You can also email saveoursons2013@gmail.com. We will also respond.
And if they send us your email for more information on the case, you have the appeal that you have already sent out to the public. You'd be more than happy to send them the appeal so they can see some of the factual aspects of the case. Am I correct, Ms. Fulton?
Yes, that's true. That's true. We'll be glad to provide any of the information to help you conceptualize that Michael is in need of assistance. If there's a listening audience with an attorney, legal expertise, who has the skill, the heart, and the desire to help, please contact us. If you have a computer expert who understands these issues, feel free to contact us.
Now, Ms. Fulton, can you just talk in general what the outreach and support has been up to this point as relates to you talking to or contacting churches, lawyers, people who are supposed to be of good conscience and say they want to help the community? What has been the general support up to this point? And just be honest with our audience and let them know.
The computer experts that we have spoken with indicate there's one that we really do respect and we really would appreciate having on board, indicates that they would like to have access to the same computer that the DA had access to. They would like to have access to the same technology that the DA had access to. And I'm sharing that with you because it is our understanding that the public defender is not prepared to support that kind of request. Their preference is to send a disk to a computer expert, hoping that they would analyze that. From our perspective, as a layman and as a mom, that would seem to undermine the integrity and objectivity of a professional computer expert. The response that we've gotten from the attorneys, there are several attorneys who have expressed an interest. They indicate that they are aware, to a certain extent, computers can be used and manipulated. They would ask to make an entrance onto the case for a sum of $25,000. There are other leaders in the community who are reluctant, afraid to support or get involved because they too understand that if Michael is truly a target, their support of him might jeopardize their safety as well. At times, we feel as if we are being challenged in more ways than one, but we cannot afford to ignore these charges. We cannot afford Michael's future, and we cannot neglect him based on dollars and cents.
Interesting. Very interesting. I would like to address this question to Haki and then Margarito. Start with Haki first. Haki, you made a statement. You made a statement earlier that it's important for us to come to the defense of our youth, to try to see that there's value when we say that we're looking for good role models, children who do the right thing. And there's a value in that. If that is the case, can you speak to this question, Haki? How do you reconcile lawyers refusing to take the case based upon their inability to get paid when, at this point in time in their development, in their career, money is not the major issue for was self-sustaining? What do you say to lawyers in general, and African lawyers in particular, who may know that cases are not just, but because of the fact they can't get paid, they will let innocent people suffer? How do you deal with that, Brother Haki?
You know, it's a very peculiar value system. It starts with this premise that things define who you are as a human being. See, this is the fundamental problem that we face in society. We're conditioned in society to believe that, in fact, things or class determines who we are as human beings. And so, therefore, we have the big house, the big cars, the big bank accounts, and so, therefore, because we have these things, that somehow now we're more of a human being. Now, the absurdity is that once you start thinking that things define you as a human being, what does that mean in terms of if you don't have access to things? Does that mean you're less of a human being? So it's a peculiar kind of logic that exists, and unfortunately we are conditioned to believe, many of us, to believe in fact that things don't define us. And so as a lawyer, when you think that your obligation is to justice because you spend your time going to school because you want to pursue justice, because you want to create a better world, at least in the ideal world. But apparently, a lot of individuals leave law school with the premises about making money. It's not about terms of serving the greater good. It's not about creating a better society. It's about how much money can I get. Historically, that was a Wim Counselor. Was very good in terms of representing people pro bono because he understood the nature of the injustices that permeate the system, and so therefore, in terms of just the human being, he couldn't sleep at night knowing that he acquiesced to wrong about not representing people simply because they didn't have access to money. So, his practice was taken over by Ron Kuby, who continues the legacy today in terms of representing people, who are, well, in fact, indigent or people who can't afford, people accused of very heinous kind of crimes, knowing full well that the people not guilty of those crimes or having only that they're not in a position to pay lawyers in terms of defending them. So this peculiar paradox in terms of what is it to be a human being that's winning America, which is going to lead ultimately to the demise of this whole system, because it can't stand. When you got millions of people walking around thinking that things turn them as human beings, then it's nothing they won't do in terms of acquisition of those things. And so therefore, things like justice, honesty, integrity, fair play. Provide for human needs, all those variables get swept to the side because in the minds of people who think that things determine them as a human being, they're not going to do anything that's going to undermine their ability to get things. So it's a absurd kind of system that permeates society, and it's one that unfortunately exists in the world of law and medicine. So, having to understand that, that's why it's so crucial in terms of, having people to assist a young brother in terms of raising funds, in terms of getting what he needs, in terms of a rough lawyer to fight this case.
Sister Margarita, would you like to respond? And at the same time, I'd like for you to address the issue of how can people participate, how can they help Michael? What are some of the things they can do from your perspective?
Well, I think that change happens with each individual. And I believe that it's going to take a grassroots effort to bring about this change. And the way that they can help Michael is to really get back into holding individuals who are taking public office, whether they're district attorneys or public defenders or the system itself, into account and questioning the abuses. and getting busy and saying that the transparency, that if you cannot provide us with transparency and that these charges are not justifiable because of what Brother Hucky has stated so very eloquently, that it's a profit-based system, is to say that we need to take away the profitability, put the money into education. We need to do those things, but people have to advocate for their rights and advocate for others when they see an individual in Michael's situation going through the injustice that he's facing. But if you go to, say, for instance, any of these state courthouses or county or district courthouses, Monday through Friday, you probably have more individuals going through there than you have at any of the municipal airports where there's commerce to be made there. And what happens is that the system is a trap, and it was done by design, and the design needs to be undone. And it calls for taking away and stripping down some of these mandatory, getting rid of some of these mandatory sentencing. The focus has to be on, I think, independent auditors that are able to look at abuses, where especially I know that there was a report that when I was talking to Miss Katie Lee, Michael's mother, and we were talking about where the district attorney for the Arapahoe, Douglas County, and another county, I can't remember, recall right now, where prosecutors were getting paid bonuses supposedly for convictions. And that kind of mandate or that kind of performance-based reward at the expense of a person's life is not only immoral, it's against every human right that an individual is supposed to have in this country that so claims that it's the land of the free, because it's not. And it's hypocritical for individuals that are so placed in a position of power be engaged in such abuses, and it needs to stop. And until we are able to collectively come together to say if it takes money to make it happen, then $25 helps, or $5 does the same, but we need to do it in mass, and we can, so that Michael and others are able to get the representation that they need so that we can stop this system, and it's never to go ahead and take a plea. It's always to fight for your rights and to make the government, instead of these district attorneys being a process order, in the same way that when you go to a fast food restaurant and you say, hey, you know what, I want no pickles or no lettuce or no tomatoes, that they do not need to be, okay, well, let's go ahead with a felony one, felony two, felony three, felony four, and it's just nothing but an order taker, instead of really processing the law and having citizens be able to engage in due process, because this plea bargaining system is a joke. Hello? Yes.
Hello, Sister Katie, can you hear me, please?
I'm sorry?
Katie?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
Can you hear me, Sister Katie?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
Okay. Can you, in closing, you've got a few minutes left, in closing, make a final appeal to our audience. We have some technical difficulties, in which I have been cut off from the main line. So see if you can go ahead and talk and make your appeal and get your information. Go ahead, please.
We appreciate your help. We appreciate your support. We do know that there are many listening ears out there who are aware of the different strategies that can be used by computers. Individuals are able to use computers to invade your privacy and to undermine your livelihood. And that's what's happening right now with Michael. My son is struggling. He's holding on, but he's being challenged in a way that is exceptional. We're asking for your help. We're asking that if you are listening and care and can make a difference, contact us at Post Office Box 58, Englewood, Colorado, 80151. Save Our Sons Defense Fund, INC. You can write or make a donation by sending your information to that address, as well as going into any Wells Fargo bank to Save Our Sons Defense Fund, INC. Account number 84825270 28. As Margarita eloquently pointed out, to have this trial go to a jury in Douglas County jeopardizes my procedure. Chances are this would be an all-white jury who has already made up their mind. It appears to me that Michael is building his defense now. You can call us at 720-499-5146 or email us to Save Our Sons Defense Fund. Save Our Sons 2013@gmail.com. Again, Save Our Sons 2013@gmail.com. We will be glad to share additional information with you. We ask for your prayers. We ask for your support. We're struggling, and we're fighting for Michael's life, for his future, and for his freedom. Your help would be very much appreciated.
Sister Margarita, make your last closing statement to the public in terms of why we should support Michael Fulton. You have about 1 minute, please.
We should support Michael because this could very easily happen to any one of us. And that means grandparents, that means parents, that means individuals who have never committed any crimes that can be randomly selected because of these bots that are created maliciously and can encrypt your system as we speak. And it's important that we come together collectively to stop these abuses of the law. And we can, but we have to demand it as citizens.
And in closing, I'd like to allow our audience the right to hear all of this program in its entirety by going to our archive at www.blogtalkradio.africa-or-the-move. In closing, we ask everyone who have heard this program to do three things at the minimum. Number one, write Sister Katie and get a copy of that document of the appeal to the public and spread and share this case with the world. Number two, please send in a donation or whatever you can afford, either by check or money order to Save Our Son Defense Fund at P.O. Box 58, Inglewood, California, 80151, or go directly to Wells Fargo Bank and ask for the Save Our Son Defense Fund Incorporated, account number 84825270 28, and make a deposit. You know, this law system is based upon race and based upon money. Based upon those two factors, many times this is when you get the so-called justice. Michael needs justice. He needs your support. No public defenders can defend him. Please, church, civic organizations, students, make your contribution to the Michael Fulton case. He is one of many. We need your help. On the call of Africa on the Move, we thank you for allowing us to come to your home this evening. You can catch us at the same time, same place, every Sunday, 7 to 9. Let's help Michael. Let's help Michael. Let's join in. It's the right thing, the only thing you do. We need our unity now. We thank you.